Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santaferadiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later on in the program, we're going to be talking about the novel Full Body Wag by Lisa Gray Fisher, and once again, we'll be chatting with Bill Hutchison about animals. I'm happy now to welcome to the program Camila Bustamante. She is Dean of Community Workforce Development at Northern New Mexico College, and she's here to talk about Sostenga, the third annual Garlic Harvest Festival in Española, which is coming up this Saturday, the 2nd of July. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you, Mary Charlotte. It's a pleasure to be here.
So, Garlic Harvest, Garlic Festival, it's only June. Are we already harvesting things?
Garlic comes up early. In fact, we always take our garlic out of the ground on the 4th of July weekend. It gets planted in November. So it sits in the ground doing its thing throughout the winter. And this year, because we had a very light snow, we didn't get the moisture we needed, and we had a very cold winter, we don't have as much garlic this year as we would have hoped, but it does always come up in July.
Now, does it need cold in order to flourish?
It does best. It is a bulb, so it is a root. So it does best like anything that you would plant in the winter and look forward to seeing it in spring or early summer. So it's
like
the
your
best.
Tulips, I guess.
Like your tulips, exactly.
So garlic is something that I associate with the Mediterranean, with Italian cooking and things like that. Does it have a long tradition here in New Mexico?
It came with the Spanish as well, and there are some varieties that I've heard and I haven't seen of native garlic that was here, and I'm not sure about any indigenous uses of those garlics, but it did come with the Spanish and is used heavily, as you know, in a lot of the traditional dishes. You can't have a good chili without its share of garlic.
So. Right. So what is happening on Saturday?
Saturday we have our harvest festival, and it starts at 6 o'clock in the morning, and that is because by 2 o'clock it is going to be too hot to even be standing outside.
6 in the morning.
6 in the morning.
6. And 0, 6.
6. 6, 6, 600. Yeah,
600
six
hours.
6 a.m. Yeah.
Do people really get up that early?
They do, and it's wonderful. It's sweet. It's the morning is crisp. I'm not sure how crisp. It's been very dry, but we'll still have a lovely, very early morning wake up together and watch we're right off of the Rio Grande, so the mist is coming over the trees, even in this particular season. So it's just going to be absolutely beautiful. It's an early, early morning. We have breakfast burritos, and people eat, and then the teams start getting together. And right now we have 4 teams, and we're really not looking for too many more teams this year just because we do have a lighter harvest than we have before. But so almost every team is guaranteed to win. We have cash prizes. They go out into the field and they pick as much garlic as they can, and the one that picks the most gets a first prize of $500. The second team gets a second prize of $200. And then third place is $100. And then there'll be a fourth team and they'll get a pat on the back and a certificate, a handshake.
Now, whose garlic is this?
This is the Sostenga Center for Sustainable Food, Agriculture, and Environment at Northern New Mexico College. And it's a student-run program, a student collaborative of a greenhouse, a farm that includes the garlic field. We have chili, we have tomatoes, we have other things that we grow. A small store, so we have a tiendita that is part of a commercial kitchen. And we're soon to open the coffee shop, both at the tiendita and at the library addition that's going in. But it's all in the interest of student experience in entrepreneur development, sustainable agriculture, soil improvement, environmental science, and ultimately marketing, having your final product. So it's very much a learning process.
What does the local garlic that is growing up there taste like compared to other garlic?
It really depends on the season. What we've been able to get from our local variety is a very strong, what we would refer to as a hot garlic. Tons of flavor. Not the largest. And frankly, a larger bulb carries less flavor. But
yeah, those really big bulbs, you can roast them and they're quite mild. You can eat the whole clove. You can eat the whole head.
Absolutely. And the smaller ones, a clove in a good pot of a large pot will go a long way. So we have a medium-sized to smaller bulb that's very, very strong.
Let's talk more about sustainable agriculture and the fields that people are studying that you just mentioned at Northern New Mexico College.
You bet. First, I'll just say the premise in Rio Arriba County, and something that we all acknowledge once we really think about it, with regard to the availability of water, the original acequias systems, what the acequias systems meant to providing food along the Rio Grande, and a good Google Earth search and looking at that valley shows that it is all laid out in line with the law of the Indies, with the water structures.
Google Earth shows the acequias?
Not this, you won't, I guess if you zoomed in close enough, but you can absolutely see the way the land is parceled out. And it was in long strips rather than in squares because you did not plant on irritable, you do plant on irritable land. You don't build on irritable land. So the way it's laid out along the waterways, when you look at the long parcels, you'll notice that it goes from the acequia head to the Rio Grande, and that's why you have the long land the way it is, and it was broken up per family on these longer strips. That model has worked now for a few centuries, as we've acknowledged. It also allowed for the native peoples to no longer have to migrate up and down, but actually bring water into their lands where they were living. So it, cut down on a little bit of the migration from the cliffs into the fields and then back and forth. So it really brought that availability of water. And when we had the Great Depression in this country, we didn't have soup lines in northern New Mexico. It's one thing, and I'll say, a lot of people say, oh, yes, but we still were very poor. And I say, but we always ate well.
Right.
And we had a diverse diet. Legumes are a very important part of our diet and have always been. And now even the FDA and the public health people recognize that beans are very important to our diets. And it's one of those that we've been able to grow well all the way from the San Luis Valley into northern New Mexico. So it's really about just having a diversity of food and doing it right so that we don't deplete the quality of the soil, and being able to maintain and rotate crops so that the soil quality stays rich and viable, that we don't wear it out by a monocrop, which is something that on our small farm, even though we will always have the monocrop of garlic, we will have to be very conscious of how we nurture the soil and rotate the crop. So we're on a relatively large field at the college, and we plant different things at different times of year in order to maintain that soil quality. So it's really about assuring that those traditions of water use, soil improvement, are adhered to without using chemicals and things that will just deplete and kill the soil quality, as well as having a diversity of food products that actually enrich the system.
And, of course, legumes give back to the soil.
Absolutely, yeah. So each type of plant that we put into the ground actually takes and provides different nutrients for different purposes.
We're talking to Camila Bustamante about the third annual garlic harvest happening in Española. So this is very important work because of the reality of soil degradation in the United States and really all over the world. And it's actually, if you think about it and look at the scale of pollution building on fertile land instead of using it for agriculture, using land for things like biofuels instead of food. I mean, you just look at the big picture, not to mention soil just washing into rivers and things like that. We're in trouble.
You bet. You bet. The chemicals, most of the chemicals and fertilizers that are used, and I would say almost at, and if I had to take a guess, and even in just discussions with the state agronomist, there's probably about 10% of our national population not using petrochemical-based chemicals in the soil. That petrochemical-based fertilizer actually kills any microbial life in that soil and really inhibits our ability. So when people think that they're actually providing nutrients, they're killing off the natural microbes necessary to ensure the fertility of that soil. It's really now a movement, and when I say about 10% of the total population, but the good news is with the organics movement. And I say, there have been organics around for a while, but it's always seemed like it was this trendy, inaccessible thing to many, many people.
Well, there was organics in the whole entire history of civilization.
Absolutely, and that's the connection that we're trying to make. We're trying to say, your tradition is exactly the sustainability. You didn't have to ever go to these chemical-based fertilizers.
Because they hadn't been invented.
They hadn't been invented, and you can do it the way your great-grandfather did. They were doing just fine.
And it's so it's something that people have always done here, and then those traditions have been challenged, and now people are embracing them again.
Absolutely, and it's time to do that.
Now, is the garlic harvest that you're talking about, is that watered solely through acequias?
Yes. We're on the Vigilis ditch, so we have water rights on campus, and it is watered through the acequias. Mm-hmm.
So tell us more about the other parts of it, the tiendita, the little store, the business, and the marketing. Are people learning to market garlic and garlic products?
They are. Our students are. I know that some of them might not be as in love with garlic as they thought they were to start because they're all garliced out. But the beauty is that we have...
But they're very healthy.
They're healthy, and they smell good. The thing that we do have with the tiendita, because we have a commercial kitchen. The commercial kitchen was put on campus by Johnson Controls Northern New Mexico, which was working to get a contract at Los Alamos National Laboratory. So in 1998, a commercial kitchen, because at that time, in an economic development analysis, it was revealed that the local food was a priority in the neighborhood, that people really wanted to find mechanisms for maintaining the food traditions and capability for marketing. So the value-added component, a commercial kitchen, was built at the college. That commercial kitchen has been subsidized by the college, and right now everyone will acknowledge that the state has been seeing, as well as the rest of the country, economic hard times. And instead of closing the commercial kitchen, the Sostenga Center is really established to support in a network system the ability to keep that kitchen open, because even at full capacity with 23 producers in a commercial kitchen, it doesn't really pay for all of the costs in maintaining and keeping a commercial kitchen. And that's important for anyone anywhere who says, let's have a commercial kitchen where people can make their own products. It's expensive. But with our tiendita, which is now the little storefront where people who make things in the kitchen can also sell their goods, and many of them sell at Whole Foods and other places, they can also sell in the storefront. So that money goes back to pay in. The coffee goes in to pay in to that. The lunches for students who come and eat goes to pay in. So the whole system starts to pay for itself. So it's a dynamic system. And then the food that's being grown in the field is part of our salad bar. We have bakers who come in, and that goes back into the system. And it's a self. The goal is to keep it and work it as a self-sustaining system.
Has it gotten there yet?
We're very fortunate right now. We're working with the support of an Economic Development Administration grant. It has not gotten there yet because it's only 2 years old right now. And we are adding the coffee shop components to it later this summer, I'm hoping. But we haven't received the coffee. We have been able to keep the doors of the kitchen open even before we got the grant reissued. So I would say we're limping along without the grant, but we're still walking. With the grant, we're able to make things a little easier and move forward on some of those processes that we know will be valuable, such as we know we have a lot of apples up north. We're going to get a pasteurizer and a juicer, and we'll have good Northern New Mexico apple cider, apple juice available. So it'll be part of our system and a product that will have the Sostenga label. We do sell our garlic, and we did very well last year when the weather was different, but La Nina has created some new realities for us. So it's all a balance, and it's all a learning process. It is absolutely a learning laboratory for students and what it means to have something that can be sustainable as far as marketing and development of food.
And they're also learning about not only local weather patterns and soil and acequias and water and all those kinds of things, but what's happening in the Pacific Ocean is also affecting their harvests.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So this Saturday, the 2nd of July, Sostenga la Vida, third annual garlic harvest festival. For those of us who may not want to get up at 6 in the morning or at 5 in the morning to be there at 6 and pull garlic. Okay, what happens the rest of the day?
The day goes on until 2:30, and it's lovely. We have music. You can see, watch the people in the field picking the garlic, listen to wonderful local musicians. We're actually going to have a presentation by Tewa Women United on the Three Sisters. That would be the corn, the squash, and the bean, and how those symbiotically serve to provide the food and the nutrients necessary to have maintained a good, healthy culture in northern New Mexico for a long time. So we're really looking forward to that presentation. We have Cipriano Vigil playing. A lot of good local music, food. We have some presentations on the medicinal value of garlic. We will have a solar oven actually roasting garlic, which is always yummy to spread on some bread. And actually we'll have some homemade tortillas this year, which it just makes me nervous at the thought, but it sounds wonderful. But to have some fresh roasted garlic on a homemade
tortillas,
pretty close to living.
Worth the price of admission all by itself.
All by itself, yes. It's going to be a wonderful event. And it's just a lovely place to sit and talk and listen to music and enjoy each other's company while watching the teams pull the garlic. So it's just fun.
And there's not even really a price of admission at all.
It's not. You just show up. It's $5 for the burrito, and we have a silent auction. So if people want to participate, if people want to just donate, then it is our, if you will, it is our show for the year. It is one of those to get people more informed about what we're doing in northern New Mexico, and we do appreciate any donation that we can get. Because we are a nonprofit, it is tax deductible. So if you want a breakfast burrito for your $5, or you can just donate $5, whatever you want. But it's an opportunity to just really enjoy the day.
And some of the proceeds will go to the Children's Juvenile Diabetes Research Fund?
Yes. In fact, we should be giving a check to them at the event this year, and that turns out to be sort of a business office question, where I'll just give them a symbol of the check. But this would be from last year's harvest. We will celebrate that. It's about really healthy food, healthy people, healthy culture.
And if you eat the way you've just been talking about, which is locally grown food like beans and squash and garlic and tomatoes and all those kinds of things, you're a lot less likely to get any kind of diabetes.
You're a lot less likely to get any type of diabetes. Absolutely. The less processed the food, the better off we are, the less sugar. So it absolutely is a public health day.
Camila Bustamante is Dean of Community Workforce Development at Northern New Mexico College. And how can people find out more about the event if they want to check the website or give a call?
Yes, they can check the website. It is at sostengalavida.com, or they can call me at 747-5457. That's where they can get any more information that we'll be putting out there. We also have our sponsors listed at that site. We're very grateful to those who have contributed to this wonderful event, and I want to give a shout out to all of them. There's an extensive list, so I don't want to leave anybody out by starting to
okay.
do that.
Well, Camila, thanks so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much.
I'd like now to welcome to the program Lisa Gray Fisher. She's author of the new novel Full Body Wag, published by Sunstone Press. And she will be at Collected Works Bookstore tonight at 6 o'clock. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much, Mary Charlotte.
I couldn't resist the title of this book because I have three dogs, one of whom actually does the full body wag on a daily basis, and we call it that. And I was very surprised that somebody had chosen that title for a novel.
Yes. Well, actually, I have to give my husband credit for choosing that title, but our dog does the same thing, and it's just a delight to watch. As I have one of the characters say, it's when you've got more happiness than tail, so the entire body has to wag.
Exactly. So this is a book in which dogs certainly play a prominent part, but it's about human characters. And it's funny, years and years ago when I just started doing this show, I did a book. I had somebody on talking about an anthology of essays about dogs from Bark magazine. And reading them, it's remarkably difficult to write stories about dogs. They have to end up being about humans if they're going to be any good.
Yes, I think that's absolutely true, because dogs and people are so deeply intertwined. And I think I open with a quote from Scott Momaday, that says that very well. He says, "It is no wonder that dogs should figure in the long story of man's presence on the planet. Their tenure is the same, or it is so closely alike as to be indistinguishable. There might have been a dog in the Garden of Eden."
Exactly. So the book starts out with a writing class, and there is a teacher, which I suspect, I don't know, but might be kind of based on you?
Yes, she is in part. She is absolutely in part, since I've been a teacher for countless years, the last 18 at Santa Fe Prep. And yes, it definitely grows out of my experience as a teacher, though not one particular class. Characters are all aggregates of students I've had, of experiences that I've had. And in this case, it is a student who more or less takes over the class. And
she's incredibly annoying.
She is incredibly annoying. I call her the writing workshop monster, the one you hope will never sign up.
And they always do.
And she comes in late. She's lost. She's flustered. She's a Texas transplant in Santa Fe and has retained her sort of Texas manner. But one of her most striking characteristics is a great, enduring love of dogs. She explains that she is childless and has always treated her dogs as children, and she's certainly not shy about that. She loves her dogs inordinately, and they have created all kinds of problems in her life, which she also loves. Later on in the book, we are introduced to a character named Big Willie, who has only one eye, and who is a failed Hollywood extra.
Which is not easy to do.
No, it is not easy to fail as an extra. And he is a ne'er-do-well who rescues a dog who actually ends up more or less rescuing him. She's marvelous. She's so sharp. He definitely calls her his better half. Accidentally loses her, as he does so many things. And he becomes transformed through a rather unorthodox process into a charismatic dog healer, which is perfect for the annoying woman, Sue, with her troubled dogs. So clearly their stories are going to intersect. Big Willie is really unbelievably scummy, I guess is the word I would use. He has every flaw known to humankind, but he relates to dogs beautifully and is more or less half dog himself.
Now, is he based on somebody you met?
Initially, he was based on someone we knew when we lived up in the mountains near Penasco in the 70s. There was a character named One-Eyed John who was infamous in the hills. He was absolutely irrepressible. He had no sense of boundaries. He never cut his toenails because he thought it appealed to women, which it did not. he had one glass eye that he always took out and popped back in. And he was actually a transplant from the Lower East Side and terrorized some of the locals. But
the Lower East Side of New York.
Yes, yes, right. And is long gone, so I can speak about him freely without fear of retribution.
Right.
But he was the initial inspiration for Big Willie, and then Big Willie outgrew him and really became an aggregate of so many men that I've known and loved. And he does become more lovable as he goes along.
We're talking to Lisa Gray Fisher about her novel, Full Body Wag. So this is, in some ways, a compendium of your experiences living in northern New Mexico, where you are also a transplant. You came here, what, in your early 20s?
Yes, I did, from Colorado, not too far away.
Yeah.
But I had been in California. I graduated from Pomona College, and then I lived in San Francisco after that. And it was a time when becoming self-sustaining and self-sufficient was very important to a lot of us. So Rick became my
husband. So people who were living on communes and building these
Yes.
Organic farms and so on.
Exactly. And New Mexico was a perfect place for that.
Yeah.
And I had lived in New Mexico before, and I did love it. And so I came out to a place called El Valle, where Rick was in the process of restoring an adobe house, which was kind of a rite of passage for young people at that time. So we did that and lived up there for 5 years amongst a very zany, quirky bunch of people, wonderful people, who definitely did inspire part of this. And then the rest of it, as I say, it's no surprise, it starts in an English classroom. The rest of it comes out of my teaching experience. So both of them were really instrumental in creating these books, in this book. I have been very careful not to take anything directly from any one person or time, but together have given away a lot of my experiences to various characters,
right,
in different settings.
I love you say in the preface, it's a time in when you were there in the 70s when somebody could write you a letter or to your husband that says, the guy with red hair and a green truck who lives somewhere near Penasco, and you get the letter.
Exactly. Exactly. It was a wonderful time in that we were singular and everybody knew us. There were so few people, and there were especially so few Anglos, that yes, we were known to everyone, and we knew everyone too. So that was lovely. I had at one point thought, you know, this is kind of a place to retreat where you will be anonymous, and I found out it was exactly the opposite.
You can only be anonymous in a big city.
Exactly.
You cannot be anonymous in a yes. village or in a rural place.
Right. We once had an experience, which I didn't use, with the FBI when Patty Hearst was on the run, and they came up there looking for her, believe it or not.
They came to Penasco?
Yes, through a series of very odd and dubious leads, and they were dressed like Ephraim Zimbalist Jr. and had their van and they had their big glasses, and I thought, this is ridiculous.
Here
this
comes the fuzz.
The last place anyone could ever hide out.
Exactly.
So, but it was lovely, and the people in El Valle were so patient with us and taught us how to be good farmers, how to be good neighbors, how to reciprocate for generosity that went way beyond their means. So it was a lovely time, and I'm very thankful that we had that.
Would you like to read from any part of the book, Full Body Wag?
Well, let's see. Would you like me to read from the annoying character, Sue?
Sure.
Where she's trying desperately not to write. That's one of her goals. She has 10 minutes to write, to sketch out a story.
Yeah, she's coming to a writing group, but she just wants to basically talk.
That's it.
And thereby keep everybody else from doing their work.
Exactly. And the chapter's entitled Hijacked, because hijacking is what she does to this teacher. She takes the class away from her, and actually at the end of the chapter moves it into a teepee, her own teepee on her land. But here she is talking about the story that she's decided to write. Not write, I mean. 10 minutes isn't much time. This is a big story, you know, and I don't know where to start with only 10 minutes. See, the trip is just a piece of the whole dog story, which is really the story of our marriage, Max and me. Even though we got him, Rune, and how I named him, that's another story, we got him before we were officially married. The trip to visit Max's folks in Wharton, that was before we got married, too, and we were trying to make a good impression. Well, they were, too, because they wanted us to marry. And Take and Rune made it a family trip, you see. He was like our dog, he was like our kid, like all our dogs have been since we never had kids. I've done a lot of work around the pet as child thing with my therapist. She says we use dogs as a way to connect, to work as a team, almost like we're in the harness and they're driving. And Rune, he was so big, such a friendly mutt. Couldn't teach him a thing, except... Well, he always had a hard-on, and Max taught him how to roll over and expose it. Expose, Max would command, and Rune always did. But that's all he did. So he took up the whole back seat of the Galaxy, head lolling out the window. You'd never think a dog that size could squeeze through an itty-bitty slit, just enough to give him air when we went in to have a drink at Hip's Bubble Room, this old bar where Max used to go. But he got out somehow, and after we nearly had heart failure thinking he was lost, we found him around back, the cook feeding him scraps. And of course it was raining by then, a regular flood, but Rune had fur like a seal. The water just ran off it. Have any of you all ever owned a dog?
Lisa Gray Fisher, reading from Full Body Wag. Now, what do you do as a writer of a novel when you have characters who, like Big Willie or this Sue who is so annoying, or he who has, as you call it, every bad quality the human being can have, do you have to love them anyway?
Definitely, very much so, absolutely. And yes, I by the end I adored Sue and Big Willie, and I think they get more lovable as you get to know them, and as they get to know themselves and the group. So for me, a lot of the book was the evolution of the friendships with the between the characters, and I guess between the characters and me too. Sue comes off very strong and very sort of demanding in this first chapter, and she gets much, much mellower as she goes along and realizes she doesn't need to assert that kind of power. And Big Willie, as he becomes half dog, really starts to fall in love with people too, as dogs do.
As dogs
do. So yes, so he again acquires a much much greater empathy for the world and the world for him then as a response to that. So all of those things came out as I got to know the characters better, and as I say, as they sort of got to know each other better, developed bonds with one another.
How do you go from working with personal material? Well, first of all, did you keep journals and so on, or did you just try to remember what that time of your life was like?
I have a lot. I've always written. I've written since I was a child, and so I have a lot of material written down. And I also did write, just for myself, a nonfiction account of our time in Alvai, because I did want to recall it all. So I had that to draw on. And the fact is that we love to tell stories. So there are stories that we've told over and over again to friends, to newcomers, and so on.
When you say we...
I mean Rick and me, my husband and I.
Yeah.
And so these stories are just part of our heritage. And I used bits and pieces of them, as I say, and reassigned them. And some of them were dreams that never actually came true. And some of them were pretty close to reality, but compressed. So 14 different experiences camping make one horrendous camping trip. In the book.
Right.
Again, just the camping trip from hell.
Right.
So that's how I did it. But yes, I do know a lot of these stories are drawn from our lives, not all of them.
What are your literary influences? What novels did you read and that helped shape this one?
Oh, I mentioned some of them in the book itself. First of all, as a child, I loved dog stories and horse stories, animal stories. And I have one of the characters talk about the fact that they usually turn out pretty well because we want things to turn out well for our animals. So as a child, it was very comforting to read Albert Payson Terhune and, all of the, I can't even think of the name of the author right now who wrote Sea Star and Misty of Chincoteague and all of those stories.
Right.
That comes from way back. That's the animal side. I read so much wonderful literature with my students in class every day. And I love Garcia Marquez's storytelling voice. It's one of my favorites. So we read 100 Years of Solitude almost every year. I love dialogue. I teach screenwriting at the school too. So there's a lot of dialogue in the book, and I teach playwriting as well. So I love
at Santa Fe Prep.
Mm-hmm, yes, I like that. I like that form of communication in a narrative too. So I'm trying to think. There are countless. I love Vonnegut as a writer, and he uses dialogue, I think, beautifully, and storytelling again. We read. Another direct influence, I'm trying to think. This book has been compared to John Nichols in terms of the style and the Milagro Beanfield War, and I certainly love his work.
Yeah.
So I'm sure that was in the back of my mind, too. Every year I read Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas with students under Thompson, so some of the more graphic descriptions are probably influenced by him. And I know there are countless others that I'm just not thinking of right now. But
right. Now, did any of your own dogs make it into this book?
Absolutely. Rune was one of my dogs, the one that she's describing, and I'm afraid that the attributes given him were real. There's another dog, our current dog, Molly, shows up as a dog named Thor later on in the book, who is devoted and fairly neurotic, as our dog is. So yes, our dogs definitely made it in. And good dogs that we've had in the past, I gave to other people as well. So yes, they are definitely in there. And in fact, our dog is on the cover of the book as well.
Right.
So
which is a kind of a photoshopped collage of all kinds of people, dogs, and pickup trucks.
Exactly. And again, Rick designed it, but there were actual family members in the shot. And the truck is one that was transported from the U.S. to England because they don't have old trucks. They rust out. And this couple really wanted an old truck. The little dog that's on the running board lives on the running board, so he was part of that picture. They're very proud of their truck, and it shows up all over the internet. And, of course, Monte Sol and Monte Luna in the back.
Right.
And so on. So, yes, very much a family, a full family wag is the
full
cover.
Body, full family wag.
Exactly. Exactly.
Lisa Gray Fisher, you say in your book that you really enjoy the writing process and that while other people have to suffer for their art, you just seem to enjoy it.
Well, I said I actually feel a little guilty about that,
right?
Because from my heritage, anything that you don't suffer for can't be any good.
And what heritage is that?
Oh, it's just my Anglo-American, Western, German, European heritage, you know, that has the starving artist who has suffered and has really labored to bring forth something. But these tales were such a pleasure to write that I did feel a little bit of guilt about that. And I thought, well, why am I having so much fun with this? But I had a great deal of fun writing them. Most of them were written in the summer, because that's when I'm not teaching. And initially, I had a little trouble not setting them all in the summer.
Right.
That's when I was writing. But it's also a time of relaxation, a time of joy and pleasure. And so that was part of it. I think that's part of what comes across is the joy of a time of leisure to think and to write, to talk, to be with friends.
And going from the personal stories to a novel form that is coherent, I would think that would be one of the most challenging parts of it.
Yes, and I had actually initially not expected to write a novel. I wrote the first story, and I thought, well, that's great, and it's a story. And I read it. We have a faculty reading at prep every year. I read it. People loved the characters and the theme, and I thought, well, maybe I'll keep working on this. And then I developed another whole plot with Big Willie and his group, who are making a terrible film in Arizona called Claws. Willie is playing the mutant lobster in this film. Clearly not meant to see the light of day.
Right.
But in any case, I just kept going. And I was enjoying the characters, and I really enjoyed the process, as I said, of getting to know them and getting to develop them. Pretty soon I had a series of more stories than I used in the book. I had maybe 15 or 16, and I cut some of them. And then I thought, well, all right, let's see. These actually do connect up over about a year and a half of time within the book, and they actually do fit together. And I'm writing about a lot of the same themes, so I can find a through line for them. And that's how it grew into a novel. I was fortunate enough to have a semester off, a leave from prep in 2009, and that gave me the time to really think and connect and join all of the stories together. So that was vital. It was critical.
The book is called Full Body Wag by Lisa Gray Fisher, and she will be at Collected Works Bookstore tonight at 6:30. At 6 o'clock.
At 6 o'clock, yes. And I wanted to mention two other things. One of them is that after the reading, I will be in conversation with Jack Loeffler.
Who's wonderful and who's been on the show many times.
Yes, he's terrific, and I've known him for over 25 years. So we are old friends, and he knows many of the characters from The Hills who inspired the characters in the book.
Right, right.
Also, I should mention that the book has a website.
Fullbodywagbook.com.
Correct. And please do visit it.
Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
I'd like now to welcome Bill Hutchison. He is with the Santa Fe Animal Shelter and Humane Society. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Well, hello, Mary Charlotte. Well,
hello.
How are you?
Good, how are you?
Good. How are Milk and Honey?
Well, they are wonderful, and I have to say that Horatio is extra happy.
I always forget to ask about Horatio.
Yeah, well,
it's middle child syndrome, man. That's the kid that always gets forgotten.
It's true, and he's different.
I don't even remember my middle brother. I don't have any idea what his name is.
That's just wrong.
It's terrible. It's sad.
But anyway, last time I saw you, we were talking about chilies. Now we're talking about animals and the summer weather. And I have to say, Horatio is a long-haired dachshund, and I have never gotten him groomed before. In fact, I've barely brushed him. You know, I just kind of let him be. And this year, I got him a haircut, and he is the happiest dog in the world. And
so
I never
thought.
So we've
gone from talking about chili to talking about chili dogs.
Chili dogs, that's right. Little hot dog dogs. And when you groom a long-haired dog like that in the summer, he is now, he's unencumbered. He is not so bogged down by the heat. He runs around the dog park instead of just trying to hide under a tree where there's a little bit of shade.
Imagine you're a kid in the winter and you're bundled up in your nice warm winter coat, and then it comes into the summer and the zipper's stuck and you can't get it off.
That's right.
And it's 91 degrees and you're in the high desert and the air is thin and the sun is hot and you're in your big woolly coat. Didn't Horatio such a favor?
I know, but the thing is, there are some dogs that have a kind of undercoat that provides an insulation for them. What dogs are you supposed to groom and not groom in the summer?
Grooming is really tricky. We have some great groomers in this community, and it's really important. You know, a lot of people, I remember I lived up in Chimayo for the first 3 years that I moved back to New Mexico, and Chimayo at the time had chows like New York City has rats, and people would get their chows, and they would just completely shave them down to the skin in the summertime. And I'll tell you, I have never seen more. They're happy for the first day or two, and then all of a sudden you've got all these sunburned dogs who are really unhappy.
No.
And that's one of the things that I think is really important to remember is that dogs' coats provide a lot of different things for them. It's protection from the elements. It's not just protection from the cold, but it's also protection from the sun. So when you're grooming a dog, even like Horatio, those of you who are Facebook buddies with Mary Charlotte will have seen the photo evidence of her grooming. She left enough on that he's got good sunscreen, good sun protection.
Yeah, maybe half an inch or 3/8 of an inch of
clipping him down
hair.
To the skin. You're not doing him any favors. Sometimes all your dog needs, naturally, you know, they want to shed that winter coat. Sometimes all your dog needs is a really good brushing out. There's some really excellent brushes out there. And while we are not paid to endorse any products, there's a brand of brushes out there called Deferminator, and I use them on my long-haired cat.
Deferminator?
Deferminator.
Oh, Deferminator.
Deferminator, yeah. I'll be back, but the fur won't. And it's really just some of the best brushes around, and it's what keeps my gigantically fat long-haired orange cat from broiling inside his skin like a potato in the summertime. And I think knowing the particulars of these things are really important. Believe it or not, grooming isn't all that expensive. And we're not talking, you know, putting pom-poms on your poodle or any of that sort of horrendous nonsense. No offense intended to those who do that horrendous nonsense. But it's really just figuring out how to unstick the zipper, as it were, and get your critter ready for the heat. Because it ain't easy being an animal in the summer. They're not telling us, hey, you know, we're walking on the asphalt and you've got tennies on and I got nothing but my little bare feet and it's been sunny all day and that the asphalt and you know, just soaks up the sunshine and sends it right back into the sensitive pads of our cute little dog's feet.
Is there anything you can do for their foot pads?
Don't walk them on hot surfaces. I mean, it's there are.
I mean, you're supposed to put Vaseline on them afterwards or aloe or something?
You can get products, these little walking boots. But I did try this once with my Great Dane, rest in peace, when she was a puppy. And I've never seen a dog try and get all 4 feet off the ground before until I put these little protective booties, because we were hiking on a lot of sharp gravel up in Chimayo at the time. But I don't think that works all that well. The thing to do is just plan out where you're going to be walking. Don't walk on a black road. Black absorbs heat. So take your dog for a little hike up Atalaya. Bring a little water bowl with you. You know, go to the dog park. Walk on some grass. You know, find cool places. If you wouldn't walk on it with your shoes off, don't ask your dog to walk on it with their shoes off.
And one of the rules of thumb that I have begun to learn.
We call them rules of paw.
Rules of paw. That's what I meant. Yeah. Is that If I'm thirsty, they are too.
That's it. Exactly. It's funny. We went for a hike with my little stepdog the other day, and we thought it'd just be a short little walk. So we did not pack water, which is like the perennial rookie mistake when you're hiking in Santa Fe. 2 hours in, I was so terribly thirsty, and I thought, oh, my God, I'm like the worst dog step-parent ever because I don't have anything for her to drink. And if I'm parched, indeed, she's parched. So when you're walking, there's the other little bit. Take water. You know, your dogs are close to the ground where there's a lot of heat radiating back up. Take water. Be smart about where you're hiking. Don't push them. I see a lot of people running long distances with their little dogs, and your little dog just ain't always the triathlete that you are. So just you got to be sensitive to their needs. You don't drag your 5-year-old kid along on a 10-mile run. And you know, I know that there are some dogs that are ready and raring to go, and even more that want to, but frankly, probably shouldn't.
Then there are just the incredibly obvious things, which we have to state once a year, whether you like it or not, which is when you go out, if you leave your dog outside, make sure your dog has shade and water.
Absolutely. And the shelter, you need to bear in mind that we live in a heliocentric solar system. So if the shade that you've set up for your dog is in the sun, in the shade at one point, recognize that the sun turns. And working with our partners,
you mean the earth turns.
The earth turns. Thank you. Just kidding, Copernicus. Are working with our partners at Animal Services and Animal Control, they run into a lot of people who have sort of lean-to shanties for their dogs, which are great in the morning, and they see the lean-to's in the shade in the morning. But come the afternoon, man, that dog's got nowhere to go.
And they get traumatized by it. I've seen dogs who were rescued from places like that where they were in the sun all the time without any shelter, and those dogs are phobic of the sun.
Oh, yeah. It's really dreadful. It's you got to make sure that you have a secure water bowl. We all know that as smart as many of our dogs are, it's many times have they knocked over their own water bowl while doing God knows what they do around a water bowl. So finding a secure water bowl, a big giant bucket, something outside that they can't tip over, or that you got a backup plan if they do tip it over, all these things are dreadfully important. There's a band that I played on my now defunct KSFR radio show called Dogs Die in Hot Cars, and I liked to play a song of theirs in the summer just because it was a chance to do a little PSA. For God's sakes, if we've said it many times, just don't put your dog in the car in the summertime. We all know.
And don't leave it there and go shopping for 45 minutes at Trader Joe's or
frankly,
whatever.
15 minutes in our thin mountain air. You think there's a breeze, you crack the windshield, and we've gone over on our segments many, many times over the years the math of how quickly it heats up and how hot it gets. And unless you are actively seeking to broil your dog for a dinner party, do not take your dog out in the car in the summertime. Unless you're like going out, you got the AC on, and you're heading for the dog park, or you're taking him to get tutored.
I have to share one thing that has to do with not knocking over water bowls, but knocking over garbage cans, which is one of the hobbies of especially the dachshund. I don't know how he does it. He's knocked over garbage cans 100 times his size.
He's also knocked over garbage mans, from what I've heard.
Not so much, no. But the garbage can in the kitchen was a particular venue for them to go scrounging around in and knock over and eat everything inside and strew it all over the house, which is unpleasant. And I found the perfect solution. I put a piece of Velcro on the front. I taped a piece of Velcro to the top of the can. And when you close it, it just closes all by itself. The Velcro just flops down onto it. And I've seen a knocked over garbage can every single day since I put the Velcro on, and they can't get it open.
That's very, very smart. I thought you were going to say you put a piece of Velcro on the garbage can and a piece of Velcro on the dog so that he stuck to it after he knocked it down.
That would also be
the image was
a possibility,
comical, albeit cruel.
Not quite as practical.
No.
Bill Hutchison. Bill Hutchison is with the Santa Fe Animal Shelter and Humane Society, and many wonderful dogs and cats and other animals up for adoption there.
Check out our website, www.sfhumanesociety.org, to see their beautiful little furry faces.
Excellent, and thank you for being with us once again.
Always a pleasure, Mary Charlotte.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org. Thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news, then jazz.